Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. Detoxing from sin more than personal. It's cosmic. This study connects Leviticus 23, the Shema prayer found in Deuteronomy 6, Zechariah 14, and Colossians 2. We'll see how God's appointments detoxify both spiritual leaders and everyday people from toxic habits, false religion, and spiritual distractions. Discover how unleavened bread, the Sabbath, and the festivals of the Lord all point to the Messiah as our ultimate detox, restoring us from slavery to freedom and leading us back toward the garden of God's presence.
So the theme of what we're talking about here today, don't leaven up heaven's appointments with humanity. And we see heaven's appointments with humanity. That's what we saw there in Leviticus chapter 23. And as one of those parts of what we read in Leviticus 23, we're talking about leaven, or you could say something that makes things rise. We think of yeast or things like that that make something rise. And one of the parts of those appointments in there in Leviticus 23 is related to unleavened bread. And that's all a part of a detox. Because as we'll be seeing through this, a lot of what we read about here today is about detoxing. Detoxing of the leadership. The leadership need to detox from the things that can drag them and drag what they do down. Because the whole point of the leadership of the people of God is to help people approach God. And if what they're doing and what they're involved with is getting in the way of that, they need to detox from that. And likewise, you saw there in Zechariah, and then the part we're talking, we saw in the letter to Colossians that the Apostle Paul wrote, these are also about detoxing, but this is part of a wider thing where Leviticus was talking specifically to the leadership. You've got to detox from the things that are going to keep people away from approaching the creator of heaven and earth. So then, you see the message there for Zechariah and into Colossians, that those messages was about, hey, you common people, the people that are looking to approach God from here and there, to detox away from your practices, or as the Apostle Paul puts it, those elemental principles of the world, the things that seem right to people in the way they go, and the way that the nations and other belief systems think that you should abase yourself to get heaven's attention, so to speak. So, you know, the picture we're you see on the cover here is a little theme of what we're taking a look at, where, you know, just like you can have a couple and you can have one who is really distressed that the other person is distracted by the things going on. In this case, you see the husband distracted by watching TV or something like that, distracted from paying attention to the things that really matter, and that is the relationship going on here. And that is what a key part of what we saw there in Leviticus was all about, was a leadership that's too distracted by other things to pay attention to the things that really matter. So we can think of how each one of us start our day, and I have to admit, this is a strong pull. My day job is working in the news business, and one of the things that people in the news business always like to do is figure out what's in the news and what all the hot stories are for the day. So one of the things that is a huge pull, right? The first thing I wake up is to do what? Grab my phone and start looking and seeing what the top stories of the day are. And all of us can feel pulled to say, okay, we start pulling in the things from here and there without really getting a first reset or a first setting where it is that we're going, our first kind of direction and where we're going for the day. So that's why you see the ancient practice that you'll see as a tradition that came in through the Jewish culture is to start your day as part of it. Amongst one of the things is with the Shema. And that Shema just means hear, O Israel. It starts in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, and goes on. So let's just read a portion of this here, and we read it here earlier in our services today. But hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. You got to catch a pattern there about ours, yours, taking ownership of this. Continuing on there in verse 6 of Deuteronomy 6, these words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. So in addition to just this tradition of reciting this prayer and taking ownership of this prayer, making it actually yours, is to do just as this is talking about, the traditions of binding them as a sign on your hand and as on your forehead. You might have heard of either phylacteries or something like that and seen pictures of various types of phylacteries, which depending on the traditions, they have them on different sizes, made of different materials and different styles. But the idea is that you are fixing them on your right hand, the symbol of what you're doing, and on your forehead, the symbol of what you're thinking. And that idea of what you see in the Bible about your heart and mind, it's all about what your thoughts are and also what your emotions are. So all the idea there is that you're binding the words of God into your thoughts and your emotions and also in what you're doing. So thus, and you'll also see it came into the practice as we see there going forward. And write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And you probably have seen another tradition that's come up of putting the boxes of different designs on them. But the term for it is mezuzah, which just means doorpost. And you put that on the doorposts of your house. And some people go further and put them on interior doorposts of your house, etc. But the idea is just as this is talking about, you are to bind them as a sign and write them on the doorposts. And there's even traditions about acknowledging them when you are entering the house and leaving the house. Some go further than that, but the idea is that you acknowledge this on a regular basis. However, if these things are on your hand and on your forehead and on your doorposts, but they are not actually in your thoughts and in your emotions and in your actions, then okay, it's become a tradition, but it hasn't gone into your life. And it hasn't gone up to what it says here before, that you're talking about them, that with your children, you're walking through them day by day by day, and they become a part of your life and what you do. So that you're taking these instructions into everyday life. They're not just something that sits on the wall, sits on your hand, sits on your forehead, sits on a shelf. These are things that become a part of who you are, and they get communicated from one generation to the next generation. So this goes on here in Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. Then it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, to give you great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. Starting to see a pattern there. So, not something that you accomplished yourself. And you eat and are satisfied, then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery. And that's why we around Passover time, we always talk about that you are thinking about this not as something that happened thousands of years ago, but as how each of us have our own house of slavery that the God of heaven and earth has delivered us from that. So each one of us reflect on where our own slavery is coming from. What are the chains that have held us? What are the things that heaven needs to break us free from and deliver us from? And it continues on here in Deuteronomy 6, verse 13. You shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name, and you shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you. For the Lord your God is in the midst of you, is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. So one of the things that you see as a, you could say, a warning or a remembrance is that this, in the context of it, is said to the second generation. You know, so you've probably seen like something like the Prince of Egypt or the Ten Commandments, and you see Moses and all of the people coming out of Egypt and being delivered. So that's the first generation that comes out. But one of the things that you see if you read on through the book of Exodus and then the book of Leviticus, but then also in Numbers, which recounts more of this journey, you start seeing that there is a whole lot of what? Grumbling about the leadership. They don't like how Moses is running things, and about really how the Lord is leading them, how God is leading them out of the house of bondage out. And you see continuing calls, we want to go back. We want to go back. And talking about, oh, hey, the food was so much better there. We had so much of a better experience there. And, you know, we notice that on a regular basis. When each one of us is detoxing from something, what is a common thing that happens to us? You know, both as a bit of a behavior thing and also even physiologically that can happen. We want another hit. We want another hit from what it is that we're detoxing from. We start feeling some sort of things and pull back to where we were before, even if we realize how bad it was. You see some things where they talk about in Proverbs. It's a kind of a very graphic thing, like talking about how a dog will return to its own, post-dog product. And you think, oh, that's absolutely horrible. But in a sense, that's what you're talking about with the Egypt experience. You are being taken out of your toxic situation toward a place of freedom, but you want to go back to the toxic situation. You want to go back to that again, where heaven is trying to detox you out of it. And so, thus, this is the message that you see in Deuteronomy for the second generation. Second generation coming out. Their children, the children of the first generation delivered, are saying, okay, this second generation, they are going to go in. So that's when you come into the New Testament, you see this whole talking about being born again. You may have read John chapter 3, and you see this whole talking about you must be born again. You must be born again. And this message to one of the leaders of Israel saying, hey, you should have gotten this message when you read your scriptures. And that really comes from this whole experience of traveling from the house of bondage, from Egypt, into the promised land where they were going, is that our first generation, who we were when God delivered us out of our house of bondage, that generation of us has to die. That our next generation is the one that actually goes in, so that we ourselves become a new person through this whole transformation period. So that is one of the huge lessons that is coming through of this. So when you think of some of the big ideas of what we are looking at in the passages we went over here today, Leviticus 23 is really spanning a whole part of this message that God is giving right from the beginning down through the end. That from the Garden of Eden to the tabernacle, which is the topic of Leviticus, to the Messiah, to the New Jerusalem, talked about like in the book of Revelation, and even in Zechariah that we are reading here today, that the testimony is heaven wants to dwell in the midst of humanity, wants to dwell in the garden. You see the picture that the Creator was walking with humanity. There, when you see in the tabernacle, the whole reason it was built, you read that at the end of the book of Exodus, and all the, sometimes gets boring, looks like architectural digest descriptions of how the tabernacle is constructed. That's all about saying, I want to dwell in the midst of the people. I want to dwell in the midst of the people. So the whole part of what we were talking about, a detox, is that if you were to drop something that is so other from the people in the midst of where you're dwelling, there's a little bit of more than just a culture shock, a whole lot of other shock that comes in there. And that is communicated with the tabernacle, where you basically have to go through and how the tabernacle is constructed. You're saying that you just don't stay how you are. You become transformed in the process of moving toward the presence of God. You come with your offering, as was mentioned here today, but the offering has to be in a certain way and talked about it as being perfect. And we'll be getting into a little bit of that here later, but the idea in the message that's supposed to be communicated through all of Leviticus is that something that is not you, that is perfect, is going to then take you closer to what, to who God is. And that thing that is not you is going to give its life and then take the blood, which gets keep communicated throughout the book of Leviticus. Life is in the blood. Life is in the blood. Life is in the blood. Telling you, hey, there is a life exchange going on here in the process. So this is what keeps getting communicated. God wants to dwell in the midst of the people. The people need to detox. How do you get people who need to detox close to the Creator of heaven and earth? You have to have a substitute that gives its life for you to then approach, and you are brought near. So, thus, when we see in Leviticus 23, these weekly and monthly and annual cycle of these appointments are reinforcing and teaching how heaven is making this happen, how heaven is making this possibility that you can have the Creator of heaven and earth dwelling in the midst of the people, and that they are transformed, taken out of their own houses of slavery, houses of bondage, freed from that bondage, and then brought close to the one who made all things and set all things in motion. So, and this is all really parallel, and these appointments, these daily, monthly, annual appointments, are parallel to what we just saw there in the Shema in Deuteronomy 6, lessons that parents teach their children daily and throughout the day. These sorts of lessons that are going on throughout the day are also parallel to these lessons that God is teaching everybody through these weekly, here, we're here today, this is one of them, and through the monthly, talking about the lunar cycle, and then for the annual ones that show up like Passover and the Day of Atonement, which we read about today, and the Festival of Booths. So when we also are taking a look at the book of Zechariah, if you were to look across the whole book, you see a number of these way markers of who this one is. We talked about in Leviticus, there is one who's going to give life so that those who are far off from God can be brought near to God and detoxed in the process. So Zechariah, throughout the whole book, describes a bit about how this process is going and who is going to do that. You see that in the foretelling of the humble king coming riding on a donkey. And in Zechariah chapter 9, then you see the one who is pierced there in Zechariah 12, and the shepherd who is struck and the sheep are scattered there in Zechariah 13. And then finally, what we read here today with the divine king coming in Zechariah 14. So throughout the entire book, you see this picture that there is suffering that is endured, a part of the detox process. But in the process of it, it is to take note of what needs to change. This is not just going through suffering just to make yourself agonize. It's saying, hey, there has to be a break from the things that were holding you and chaining you down before. You don't want to go back there again. To learn what it was that was the problem. Yeah, because we all deal with this thing of we go through challenges and struggles and they keep coming upon us. And we wonder, well, why do these things just keep happening to us all the time? Well, sometimes we have to just sit and take a very close look at it. And one of the things you see in the Word, it talks about there that you pray for wisdom. In James chapter 1, talks about, hey, if these trials come upon you, pray for wisdom. Pray for wisdom. Why is this happening? And pray for perseverance to get through it. And in the process at the other end, you are then become mature and complete, and you're not lacking anything out the other side because you're not tossed back and forth by everything that comes at you, and you're just totally at a loss of where anything is going. Where when we are becoming mature and complete, yeah, problems still come at us all the time, but we are not completely shaken by them because we realize where the true rock is. They're not in some sort of crutch that we lean on and gets kicked out from underneath us on a regular basis. No, we can depend upon something that will not change. And we hear the testimonies of those that down through time, they're called martyrs, that have gone through all kinds of suffering and hardship. But the one thing that the people have even tried to break out of them, they could not break because it was something that was not an external. This was something that was eternal, that they were leaning and depending upon. So that cleansing then leads to victory. We see there in Zechariah 14, and that victory is something that is leading to a worldwide detox, which is where you see with how Zechariah 14 closes out. And there, the whole process of that, it's not just a whole part of smiting or dropping some sort of hammer on the rest of the world. No, the whole part of the process is to detox the entire world out of it. And then in that final analysis, then everything is declared holy. It's just become separate out of where it was before. That's what the word holy means you throughout the Bible, is set apart or made separate from. So if we're moving from people who we used to be, moving to the place where God moves us, we move from being not set apart or far off to being set apart or brought near. Then you see in Colossians 2, this is talking in a different setting. Zechariah is talking. I mean, we saw there in Leviticus, this is talking to people who were, in the midst of traveling from their house of bondage to their land of freedom. Zechariah was talking to people who hundreds of years later, after what we saw in Leviticus, after the whole Exodus thing, they are had to go through a big time out and exile into another land and then brought back again and restored. But a whole part of the restoration process of the people of God was, did you realize why there had to be the correction that came? Did you realize that? And when you're brought back, are you just going to repeat the same thing over again? Or are you going to realize what the problem was the first time? So they're talking to Colossae, or this Greek city that Paul, the Apostle Paul, was writing to here. You see that they also are detoxing from traditions and ways that were, you know, far off from the creator of heaven and earth. And so, you see, Paul was writing to them, these people who are detoxing from those ways of life and those practices of other gods and other religions, that's, you're saying, no, this is not really going to be a choice between whether you're going to choose the Messiah or the Torah, the words of God. Rather, no, what you see, it's a choice between fullness that comes in the Messiah, and you have spiritual systems that are built on human authority or mystical pride or some self-imposed severity. The big 50-cent word for that is asceticism. People who are ascetics, they want to just separate themselves from everything and make things austere upon themselves, in the sense of trying to then remove everything from their lives and thus become separate and become closer to heaven. And that's what one of the big lessons you see at the end, the punchline of Colossians chapter 2, is that what your real detox method is the Messiah. Because the Messiah is the culmination of what is talked about there in Leviticus. The Leviticus detox is foreshadowed there by your offering, the thing that brings you near, the thing which gives its life, pours out its blood, which is life, and then substitutes for you, then taking you in as being somebody different. Kind of like old generation coming out of Egypt, new generation, second generation that enters the land. That's kind of like what you become, and it's foreshadowed there through the whole offering process of the tabernacle. So that the ultimate offering, thus, is the Messiah. And so thus, this is the way that you detox. Not just trying to deny yourself of all things, shut everything out, and thus get closer to the creator of heaven and earth. The Messiah himself taught a parable about that, and we've mentioned it on quite a few occasions, where he brings it forth as the someone who had a house and unclean spirit. And you get the picture that this was creating a problem. And so they threw this unclean spirit out of the house. And you see that this unclean spirit then goes out into some, it talks about waterless places, just out in the desert where there's nothing around. And you see the Messiah talks about this as someone then sweeps his house clean. He sweeps the house clean. So he's thinking, oh, okay, problem solved. I got the problem out of the house. I cleaned up the mess. Now everything is just fine. The house is empty. And the parable continues on, and the Messiah says, hey, the unclean spirit looks and sees, hey, the house is unoccupied. It's nice and tidy and clean. The mess has been cleaned up, but it's unoccupied. So then the parable continues that this unclean spirit gets seven worse than itself, goes in and occupies the house. Goes in and does the squatter's rights on it, takes it over. And then the punchline of the parable is that situation at the end was worse than the beginning. So the lesson is, just don't think that you're going to just take the problem out of your life and just make your house clean in the sense of, hey, I'm just going to get all of the problems out without filling your house with something that will prevent the squatters from coming back in to occupy your house. So the unclean spirits, these forces of the adversary of God that is coming in to really wreck the house yet again. So that is part of what, getting back to Colossians chapter 2, is the lesson for these people in Colossae. Yeah, it's just, hey, if there's, in Greek philosophy of the time period, the ascetics were saying, this is one way that you can purify yourself from the excesses of society. Because, you know, if you've ever read about Greek culture, I mean, it's got movies about Greek culture going on right now, and one of the things that you'll see in various strains of Greek culture of the time period was excess, lots of excess that would go on. And some people just got sick of it. They got sick of the pantheon and all of the excesses that are of the deities, and so they wanted nothing to do with it. So you had some of the philosophies that came in with asceticism. We are just going to deny ourselves, we'll restrict our food, we'll cut back on this, cut back on that, cut back on the meats, cut back on this, cut back on that. And in that sense, we will get closer to the divine. So one of the lessons that Paul is giving to these new believers is, hey, yeah, it can sound great that you're going to just deny yourself and get closer to the divine. But the true thing is, you're not actually getting closer to the divine. You're just denying things. So that's one of the things that you see throughout Scripture, is that having a part of where you are focusing your attention is good for focusing your attention for a point in time. For example, there is a number of things throughout Scripture talking about fasting, where you have a fast. We have a day of fast, which is called the fast, where we have the Day of Atonement, and fasting is a part of that. Why? It focuses you. It gets your attention. And even regularly talking about principles of fasting in that. But that is not a key to the divine. Just as when you get hungry, that is not just to the point of then reaching the divine in the process. Rather, what is it that you fill your life with? Not just denying yourself or even filling yourself with things that are other than what can truly fill you. Because sometimes we can just fill ourselves and keep filling ourselves and never, ever get full. Because there's always just one aching thing that is just left there as a big hole. So when we get back to one of the other passages and closing out our overview of these big ideas here in Leviticus 22, one of the things that all talks about instructions for the priests, and the looking under the hood there, the word is the Kohanim, or the priesthood. These people are to be looking for, and the Hebrew word under the hood is mum, or it looks like mum, but it's mum, and that is the word translated as perfect, unblemished. So that is what the picture that the priesthood needs to be looking at. Because, like what is mentioned in this particular passage of Leviticus 22, builds on something we talked about last week when we looked through the book of the prophetic book of Malachi. And Malachi was another, you could say, smackdown of the leadership and the priesthood, saying, hey, look, you're showing up here with animals that were just like all the things we read here today that you don't bring to the creator of heaven and earth. They were bringing these things. They were bringing offerings that were lame and had all kinds of defects and that. And they just were not getting the picture that this is not what the boss asked for. When you think in our daily lives, and we have jobs and whatever we work for, if our bosses are calling for this and we bring something that is opposite for it, or some things that just are not even close to the quality that your boss is asking for, what then do you have an issue with your boss? Your boss is like, what are you doing? Okay, you brought me sort of what I asked for, but you didn't pay attention to what the quality was that you were bringing. And you see actually in the prophets where it comes back and asking the leadership, would you present this to your own governor? Then why are you then bringing that to the creator of heaven and earth and thinking that this is something that's going to be acceptable? So the reason that that is important is, remember again, what these offerings are representing. These offerings are representing something that is going to take the place of those worshipers who are trying to approach the presence of God. This life that would be poured out on their behalf to then bring them, to detox them forward. Well, if those people in charge who were supposed to be bringing and supervising these offerings just don't care at all about what is being presented, then what message is that going to give to the people who are coming near? Yeah, that this offering is nothing special. You can just bring this or that or the other. It's not anything that's particular. Tammy has a comment or a question over here.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this week at my work. My boss actually had us, he hired this company to survey all of us about what we liked and what we didn't like about our jobs. So that's him exercising humility, wanting our opinion about our jobs and all that. But what you were saying earlier, the verse is true too. So one of my main jobs at my work is that I have to write the demands that are presented to the insurance company. So I had written kind of a rudimentary basic demand on this one case. And so I sent it to my boss and he says, why are you sending me this style of demand? This is one of those cases where we need to pull out all the stops. And so I replied to him and I explained my thought process. And he replied to me, he says, well, I understand where you're coming from, but we need to do this. So if I had responded to him with arrogance, with, you know, talking down to him or anything like that, what would have his been reaction? It would not have been a teachable moment to me. It would have been a smackdown. But because I responded to him in humility and I answered his question, then he responded to me with a teachable moment with humility. And it didn't break our relationship, if you will. It didn't become a confrontational relationship. So when we are as servants of God, you know, we make mistakes. So if we ask God, what is our mistake? Why do you think this is a mistake? And he replies to us and shows us a mistake. And we acknowledge that repairs the relationship. But if we come back in arrogance, then like with the prophets, we might get a smackdown. And, you know, so that's what heaven is asking of us. He doesn't ask us to be perfect. He asks us to be humble.
Yep.
And to listen. And if we make a mistake, instead of doubling down on it and telling God why he's wrong, look at why we're wrong.
Yeah. To follow the one who is lifting us up higher. And that's a whole part of what all of these things about being spotless and blameless is all about, is pointing us to, hey, this is the care and the service that heaven is giving to us, and saying, this is how special this is and what heaven is looking to do here. So last, we'll just kind of wrap up with what we had looked at with Leviticus 23 and these feasts of the Lord. And just one of the key things to look at is, in this particular chapter, it lists three basic categories of them. And we kind of mentioned at the beginning, it mentions one weekly appointment or feast of the Lord. which is the Shabbat or Sabbath, comes every seventh day of the week. We call it Saturday. Then you've got the ones that come in the springtime and in Israel's first lunar month there in the spring, relatively like March and April timeframe, and goes through the third lunar month, roughly the May or June timeframe. And in those, you have Pesach or Passover, which comes on the 14th day of the first month. Then you've got Matzot or unleavened bread, which goes from the 15th to the 21st days of the first month. And then you've got two others, which one's called Bikurim or the wave offering or first fruits. And some may differ, some traditions differ on this, but roughly the 16th day of the first month. And then you probably have heard of Pentecost, and Pentecost there on otherwise known as Shavuot or the Feast of Weeks. They're roughly in the sixth day of the third month. And again, some traditions, including some in the Body of Messiah, have that on a different day as well. But those are part of the general bucket of the spring festivals. The fall festivals there are all within the seventh month, which is actually coming up here soon. It's usually in the September or October timeframe, and goes, you have Yom Teruah or the Feast of Trumpets. You'll also see it called Rosh Hashanah on the first day of that seventh lunar month. Then you've got Yom HaKippurim, or just shortened to Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, there on the 10th day. Then you've got Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. It goes from the 15th to the 21st days. And then lastly, Shemini Atzeret, or the Convocation of the 8th day, there on the 22nd day of the 7th month. Now, if you're just kind of noticing, you're a person who sees patterns and things, you'll start noticing that these numbers are mirrors of each other in the first month and in the seventh month. And it's part of a wider discussion, but there are a lot of similarities that come between what is in the first month and what is in the seventh month, because they are like bookends to each other. And they are all a part of a message that heaven is giving about what heaven is doing. And you start looking at them more, you'll see that this is something that heaven is doing through the Messiah. So just in a look for Shabbat or the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, you'll see through the Bible that there are a number of ways that this is talked about as being a memorial or a reminder of it. We see it there in the beginning of the Bible, there in Genesis 2, and also in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. It describes that God is the creator of the heavens and the earth. That is one of the reasons why it's a memorial. You also see that God is the creator of Israel through Abraham, and that Abraham is then to be a representative to the nations, kind of like you see with D-Day, and we see that, celebrate that every beginning of June, where that is a time period where you have the U.S. and the U.K. and France and Canada and a bunch of other, Australia came in and made a beachhead in France to go after Nazi Germany. So in a sense, what you see with Abraham was a bit of a heaven's beachhead into the world to start this move in into the territory that was then been occupied by the adversary, otherwise known as the kingdom of the devil or Satan. Things not God. Then you see also that the Shabbat or the Sabbath is a memorial that God is the provider of daily needs. And you see that talked about in the New Testament about give us this day our daily bread. Well, that daily bread is talked about there in Exodus chapter 16 and reflected on later in Deuteronomy chapter 8, something that the Messiah quotes to the devil in one of those temptations, where he says, you know, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Well, that is in reference, back in Deuteronomy, chapter 8, to what? You ate bread every day during this journey from the house of bondage, the house of slavery, to the promised land, the land of freedom. God gave you daily bread every day. And this was even one of the points of grumbling, because they're like, why do we eat? It even called at one point, the people of God called this miserable food. Why do you give us this miserable food? This is your daily provision, yet still wanting to go back to the toxic society that they were pulled out of. And you see also talked about in Deuteronomy 5, which is the retelling of the Ten Commandments for the second generation, you know, that reborn Israel generation that's going into the land. In Genesis, or Deuteronomy chapter 5 is where you get the retelling of the Ten Commandments. And there you see that the Sabbath commandment, the Shabbat commandment, is focusing on, hey, because that's, why do you celebrate this, memorialize this? Because the Lord has liberated you or freed you from slavery and removed, as a part of this removal of the obstructions that we have between us and God. And you see, as you move through scripture, that in Exodus 31, you see that Shabbat or Sabbath is also described as a sign that God is the, use another 50 cent word, sanctifier, or the one who makes you holy. A reminder, so every week you get this reminder that you should not be holier than thou, because he is the one who is holy. He is the one who is other, separate. And he makes us that. We don't, through our asceticism or anything else, make ourselves separate. He is the one who does that. And the Shabbat is a weekly reminder of that. And you move on into the apostolic writings, into the New Testament, in the Gospels, and you see a whole bunch of references of where the Messiah is doing healings or special teachings on a Shabbat, especially the healings. And one of the lessons that you see that gets across there is that heaven is the one that heals, that can bring true healing, where there is just no human possibility for doing something, like someone being born blind to be healed from that, for someone who's dead to be brought back from the dead. I mean, truly dead for days. To be brought back from that. That is truly the work of heaven. And when you see in a passage like Isaiah 66, which is talking about in a similar time frame as like Zechariah 14, that day of the Lord with the recreation of all things, you see that the Shabbat, the Sabbath, comes in yet again, along with the monthly reminder with the each new moon, that he is the one who recreates the heavens and the earth and all that comes upon that. So when you see just a comparison of these various appointments, you see that just like with the offerings that we were looking at earlier, that just like with the offerings, they are pointing to the one who is going to substitute, the one who is going to pour out his life so that we can all detox from being apart from God and move closer to God in the process. So you see Shabbat with all of its layers being a picture of the kingdom of heaven in all its fullness. That's why there is a tradition that goes that in Hebrew it's called Yom Shekalo Shabbat, or a day that is always Shabbat, because that is a picture of God hitting the reset button to set things back to the way he created. Because you see in Genesis 1 and 2, where creation really ends, you see that on the seventh day, he stopped. He Shabbatted. He rested. The word there, Shabbat, he stopped. And he set that apart. He made it holy. Why? To say, I am the one who does this. I am the creator of heaven and earth. So that is why this is a set apart time. As a memorial, hey, I'm the one who creates, who brought things out. So that's when we look out at trees or those wonderful flowers we see outside, or we see the blue sky or other things that God has created. Those are all reminders of the one who actually put things in order and made them. So lastly, we'll close out with taking a look at a very important lesson that we get, and basically the instructions in that we have for believers in the body of Messiah and the leadership in the body of Messiah. And you can see that we talked about that in Leviticus 22. And one of the key instructions we get from this in Acts 20, verse 28, it says, "Be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock, among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood." And that's there where you have church, that is ecclesia or the assembly, the kahal, there it is in Hebrew, the assembly of God, the congregation of God. And where you see overseers, that's where it's often used as the description for what is also called the bishop, but that idea of someone who is overseeing a whole group of communities in there. So one of the lessons that you see for the body of Messiah is, hey, you really need to have the shepherds on their A game to be watching out for the flock. Because, you know, just like around here, we're hearing about more mountain lion attacks and coyote attacks on the sheep that we have here in this area. We're getting a whole lot more sheep in this area because sheep are fantastic mowers, and they're also great for keeping the fire danger down. So the role of shepherd is growing in popularity. But in this area, there's a whole lot of threats that are coming to all these increasingly larger flocks that are here in this area. So in very like fashion, then there's the message to all of the flocks in the body of Messiah that the overseers, the watchers, the shepherds have to be on their A game for what's coming. So thus, you see some instructions that the Apostle Paul gives both to Timothy and to Titus about what the roles of these bishops or overseers or deacons or servants are to be, you know, and their whole family. So passage we look at, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1, starting in verse 1. "It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer, then, must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money." So thus you're seeing a number of characteristics and as a part of the job description for those that are going into this office should be looking for people of this particular character. And continuing on there in verse 4, "He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside of the church, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil." Yeah, so thus you see continual note that these overseers must be ones that have shown that they can really work with their own families, because that's one of the challenges that you see, that of people who are working in roles of shepherds, that they can look like they've got it all together when you're behind the pulpit or this or that, But if you look at their own families, that could be a mess. And so that's one of the things that's it's become almost then a watchword of the pastor's child, of one who is, you know, just has completely gone wild, yet lives in the home of a pastor. So continuing on there in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8, deacons, now deacon is from diakonos, which just means servant or a worker. So someone who is to a level of someone who is being of service. Deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain, but holding to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. These men must also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. Deacons must be husbands of only one wife and good managers of their own children and their own households. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a high standing and great confidence in the faith that is in Messiah Yeshua. Yes, so you see here the great standards that are for the people who are going to be serving as in the shepherd position, or even in those that are going to be they call deacons. And sometimes we may think of a deacon as whoever has got a pulse, just call them a deacon and throw them into the fray. But you see that the apostles are saying, no, a deacon is someone who is actually really shown themselves to be someone who is actually follows a good character and has shown good character in that sense. So thus, when we're seeing in this, in these instructions that are coming through for these leaders in the body of Messiah, and we think to the model that is really coming from of the priesthood, the Kohanim, you see that just as Leviticus 22 was saying to these Kohanim, look, if you are not keeping yourself from these blemishes and you have a blemished character yourself and are accepting really blemished offerings that are coming in, then you should step aside. Otherwise, it says there in Leviticus 22, you will be cut off or separated from the congregation of Israel, banished. So basically, it's saying, you leaders, if you do not basically consider yourself not worthy and take yourself out of the position, God is going to do that for you and set that aside. And some people have attributed that, and you can see some good scriptural support, especially for the first exiles of Israel, as to why those exiles happened. Because those leaders were not acting in the levels of saying, hey, my job is to point people upward, and rather what I'm doing is just dragging everybody downward. And their opinion of the creator of heaven and earth is going down because of how I'm behaving and really what I'm teaching and the standards that I'm upholding. I'm just bringing it all down. That's something that I just was quite amazed about this. I was Tammy says I'm going crazy over there. Some of these video channels of where these pilots will go through and they'll talk about air traffic control transmissions and various mishaps of planes. And they're like, how can you ever get on an airplane ever again when you're? Yeah, how can you go to bed at night when all you're doing is listening to various air disasters and such. But one of the things that you see in there is a standard across the entire airline industry that if a pilot does not think that they're up to the task, they are fully within their purview And the whole flight crew is up for that. Air traffic control will be good with that. Their airline will be good with that if they turn around and go back to the airport. Like, for example, there was one incident where the guy was flying out of an airport and his autopilot malfunctioned. And he was just at a loss for about a minute. And the first officer, his co-pilot, was like trying to get his attention. He was just like fixated because he just couldn't handle the overload of all that he had to do that the computer usually dealt with. So once he came to his senses at the other end, he realized, okay, I can't do this anymore. So he told his first officer, I can't do that, told air traffic control, told his airline, they went right back to the airport. It's like, great, we'd rather have you do that than realize you're out of it and to just continue on flying with hundreds of people behind you. So thus, how much more then should the shepherds of the body of Messiah realize, I'm out of it and realize, okay, I've got a downshift and take myself out until I'm ready to then be back into it again. Otherwise, and sadly we see the news all the time where something happens, either they themselves are doing something or they tolerate, just like how Israel was the priesthood was tolerating blemished offerings. They'll tolerate things happening within their own congregations that are just reprehensible and bring either they block people from approaching God, make them not want to approach God, like you see in the Bible with the two sons of the high priest Eli or Eli were so reprehensible in their treatment of women there trying to approach the tabernacle that people, the women did not want to go to the tabernacle anymore because of how they were acting. So thus, when you see scripture talking about judgment begins at the house of God, yes, yes, indeed it does. And that the priesthood, the leaders of God really need to step up and say, hey, we are given a huge responsibility, not something to not take lightly. And then by extension, as we started this, looking at the Shema, this is something that it's not just we delegate off to somebody else, the shepherd or the pastor or whatever. This is something that happens in each one of our lives, in each one of our households, that each one of us then is also has those that are, you know, looking to us to help them move forward, whether children or other people in the family, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where we'll leave things off here today. And any last comments or observations or thoughts? Yes, Rose.
I think our Savior and King came to show us back the way to the garden.
Yes, indeed, the way to the garden. Because that's what you see if you read Revelation 21, 22. You see the garden and the tree are back there again. So thus, you'll see that that is where heaven is trying to take us back to that situation again.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.